And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host. And I'm back in the snowy mountaintop in Maine. And we have a couple of guests tonight. First hour, we have someone who I met out in Phoenix. Her name is Lori Hines. She's an author. And she's going to be talking about the Native American culture and the Star People and some ancient times as well. I never really touched on this subject, so it should be interesting. And we have Stephen Bassett is going to be in hour two. Before Lori, we have Alejandro Rojas coming right up from Open Minds Radio. He's going to be sharing the UFO conference information that we just had last week. It was really exciting, and we're going to be chatting back and forth about that. No UFO news. He hasn't even had time to take a look. Well, don't forget, we have new T-shirts on our website. And you know what I found out? They're not real popular, so I'm going to have new graphics done. And it must be that. I can't understand why else people aren't really buying them. Only supporters bought them out at the listeners bought them out in Phoenix and no one else. So that kind of says that they're not all that good. And I apologize for that. I think they're good anyway. So speaking of that, I'm going to draw a name out of the $10 supporters for a free T-shirt that you probably won't like. So hang on just a minute. And here we have Gary Oliver, a $10 supporter who wins a T-shirt. I hope you like it, Gary. And I guess that's it for now. And we have Alejandro. How are you?
I'm still tired.
I bet you are. You did a beautiful job, and you're a hard worker, and it went off without a hitch when I was there. I don't know what happened. It must have fallen apart after I left, I'm sure.
Luckily, it did not, although during the conference, I'm always stressed and thinking about, you know, the next day, the next few speakers, making sure we've checked their PowerPoint, everything's working, where are they, I need to get them, we need to check everything, you know, what are their needs, and so it's so hectic, and you're just living kind of moment by moment. And then just popping on the stage and introducing or hosting a panel. So it's just like so stressful and running around and everything that, it really saps you. So even though I took the last 2 days off, slept most of Monday, just kind of in bed watching American Horror Story whenever I woke up. And so now it's like this is my first day back to the office, and I'm still just so tired, and my throat is still hurting. But you know what? Luckily, even after you left, even without your wonderful moral support, everything went very smoothly. Bob Lazar, luckily, actually did show up, and we were worried about that.
Yeah.
And that all went very smoothly. We were able to keep the public at bay and whisk him in and out, and everything went well.
Yes. I want to talk a little bit about Lazar. Unfortunately, I missed it while I was out there. And, you know, I got to tell the listening audience, the highlights when I was out there for me was the listeners that came up and talked to me. I had such a blast with all them. And speaking of listeners, I want to talk about Ryan Sprague.
Sprague, I call him Spragu because name is kind of spelt like Regu with SP at the beginning. Yeah. So I like to call him Spragu.
What I got to tell you, what a gentleman. What a nice guy
he is. He's awesome.
He was just such a pleasure to hang with. I really, really enjoyed him. I did get to spend a little time with Charlie Foltz, and what another nice guy he is. I mean, I've forgotten what a nice gentleman he was, and he did a great presentation.
He did. His presentation was one of my favorites. I think that's a highlight because I think their case is so important and so great. In fact, you know, luckily we were able to get some video interviews with Jim Wiener and Jack Wiener, the twin brothers who were with him. We integrated some of that into his talk, but I have these hour-long interviews where on my show I'm going to play those because Jack, who we never hear from,
right,
is such a really fun, interesting guy. They all are. They're just really salt-of-the-earth, honest, regular guys. And so I'm so excited that I'm really going to – we're going to make a video. We did more interviewing with Chuck Foltz. I want to really focus on this case because I want to bring it back and make it one of the primary abduction cases because it does rank up there with Betty Hill and Travis Walton. You know, I think this is an amazing case. And so I'm going to continue to make a big deal out of it because it's just an incredible – it's so mind-boggling.
Well, you have my support on that, you know, not just because I live here in Maine where it happened, but because I just really believe in it also. It's, to me, it's one of the most solid ones, and I think I mentioned that two or three times last week. And, hey, for the listener who's listening, also, you can go to the website, podcastufo.com, and you can see the video that was taken while behind the scenes. About an hour of that podcast is on video on our homepage. I'm going to leave it up there. I want to talk about Bob Lazar. I miss Bob Lazar. But last I spoke during our podcast with Stan Friedman, he said that he was going to actually bring up a few things during the Q&A. And I just wondered, did that happen?
No. And it's because there was – the Q&A was only George and Bob. And that was the deal. The deal was we whisk in Bob. George gets all of the questions in written form from the people at the conference, and then he asks the questions. We actually didn't have too many submitted, but of those, several of them were from Stanton Friedman. I was so busy doing this and that, and especially during George's talk or getting ready for Bob Lazar. And then, you know, I promised, and this was a kind of funny behind the scenes for people, I promised Bob, and it was the big deal, and, you know, lots of back and forth to get him in quietly and get him out quietly, unmolested by or not having to interact with anybody, with taking selfies or anything like that. I told him that's what we would do, and that if afterwards he decided, you know, he felt good about it and wanted to do some interacting, he could do that if he wanted to, but he didn't feel like that. But it was behind the scenes. Luckily, it went really smoothly because we came up with this plan on how to sneak him back there and get him. The only people that I kind of had to strong arm and push out of the room and get out of there were speakers because some of the speakers snuck back. And I won't say who. One in particular was really upset with me for screwing up his selfie, but I grabbed his phone and put it in his jacket and say, get out. And he got really mad at me. I think he's over it. But
one of the pictures made Facebook, by the way.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I know. There were a couple backstage because then I had to yell at the crew, hey, quit taking selfies and screwing around. We need to get this ready because I'm just, you know, in conference mode. We got to get this going. We got to check everything and get it rolling. Everybody's so Twitter-pated that they're like, okay, they're ready. George doesn't even have a microphone. Bob's microphone is hanging by his leg. So I'm like, what the hell are you guys doing? So it was a real, you know, just kind of a mess back there. But luckily, we got it all straightened out. We got them on the stage. We got them out. And, of course, then everybody comes rushing to come back to meet him. And I'm like, sorry, guys, he's already on the road and out of here. So he just wanted it that way, and that's what I guaranteed him. So sorry to the speakers or to people who came back and wanted to get pictures or whatever. You know, I was going to hold to my word and make sure that it was a seamless, real easy in-and-out type of situation. And luckily it was, and he was very happy with it. And I know this one of the speakers who was like, but Bob likes me. And it was like, well, he was very happy that I kicked you out. And to get things rolling. Because and he may have liked, you know, this couple other people. But, of course, we had a show to put on, and you don't have much time, and you need to get people out there and rolling. So they did not ask Stanton's questions, from what I understand, because I was really nervous, checking security, checking this, checking that. I didn't get to see a lot of it, so I'm going to have to watch the video. But people did come up to me later and said they didn't ask much about the education stuff, but people really loved it. And it was really interesting because, you know, Bob's answers are really off the cuff. You know, they feel so genuine. They feel like, you know, he really has these experiences. However, we did have a panel the next day that was really got kind of heated with Stanton and Jeremy Corbell, who interviewed Bob Lazar, is friends with George Knapp and Bob Lazar and was defending Bob Lazar. We also had Mark Pilkington, who wrote a book and did a documentary on Richard Doty. So there was heated debate about Doty. There was heated debate about Lazar. And Stanton got to get in his arguments for the education and stuff like that. So people should watch that panel. It was really good because Stanton got to get in his comments and Jeremy his retorts. But it was funny. It was heated because, of course, I jumped in there. Some people wanted to see a debate between Stanton and I about Doty, and we were able to get a little bit of that in that panel. So it was fun. And luckily, you know, the whole group are people who really respect each other and were very respectful. So
now I just saw Richard Doty on Facebook reaching out to George Knapp. George Knapp's a friend of mine on Facebook. And so it looks like, who knows, he might be coming up on Coast to Coast or something.
Yeah, I know George Knapp. Whenever I'm on Coast to Coast and I talk about Doty, often George Knapp will go, uh-oh, I'm going to hear from him. Because, you know, he's a liar. And, of course, so I often talk about the different things he's lied about. And he's admitted, you know, he says he's a disinformationist. So I just always caution, we can't trust him if he says he's a disinformationist and he keeps lying. Why do we try to believe everything, things that he has to say? And a lot of people do.
Going back to Lazar, I just have a gut feeling that the whole thing, it has nothing to do with Stan Friedman or anyone else. But right from the beginning, when I first started looking into Bob Lazar's claims, it just doesn't feel right. I don't know. I don't know if I really believe it. I just don't get that warm and fuzzy feeling. I know he's a really intelligent.
Is that what you look for when verifying cases, if you just get that warm, fuzzy feeling?
Well, it helps, yeah. But, you know, I see that, you know, he's an incredible speaker. He's really, really sharp, brilliant. But I just don't know. I don't know. You know, maybe there are parts of it that are true. But, you know, my whole feeling is that he was never even there. That's just my feeling. And I know last time I said this about him, I got some hate mail, and I'm ready for it, you know.
Well, you know, I'm not well, I'm always like this, and I think some people don't like it. I'm never 100% about anything. But I'm still on the fence with this one. I go back and forth, and George has – very compelling arguments when it comes to this case. And I want to re-review George's talk and Bob Lazar's Q&A and then go from there. And when I do that, maybe we could talk more at length about that. But I would recommend, this isn't necessarily a sales pitch, but for exploring this case, I would recommend that people get the George Knapp video and the Q&A with Bob Lazar and the panel with Stanton Friedman. And I think you're going to get a really full idea of, you know, both sides of the stories and get an idea for the feeling of the story and what Barb Lazar's claims are. And it was really funny because we did struggle. And at one point, Bob Lazar threatened to – he said, I just don't feel good about this. I can't do it.
Really?
And we were like – well, you've already signed the contract, and we've already sold tons of tickets for this, so you can't back out now.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
And he talked about that. You know, I haven't said anything about this to anybody, but he actually talked about that, which I thought was hilarious. He said something like, well, But I couldn't because they would have sued me, but in a nice way. So
they would have sued me in a nice way. Yeah.
Yeah. It was really funny that he brought that up, which was also a positive thing because it just showed he was open and about some of this stuff that could be embarrassing towards him. But that was really funny that he had brought that up.
I'm going to put a banner on my website so that'll just someone can click on right on Podcast UFO on our homepage or on the sidebar where you can get these DVDs. And I'll gladly do that once I receive the ones for free in the mail from you. I'm kidding.
You.
Yeah. Discount
speaking
rate,
of free, I really enjoyed my T-shirt that you gave me of the UFO podcast. And so I don't know what these people's problems are. We sold out of T-shirts. Maybe it was just that you were there during the beginning of the conference and not towards the end where people spend their money a little more. But thank you very much for the T-shirts. I greatly enjoy it.
Oh, that's great. Well, hey, so next week we'll be back with the real news.
Yeah, we'll be back with some news fit for radio.
Okay. All right. Hey, you get yourself some good rest, son, and we'll be talking to you next week. And it was a real pleasure recording with you out there and seeing you. It was really the highlight of the year, especially when I have 4 feet of snow here.
Yeah, the weather out here was wonderful. Luckily, the weather held up too. So it was a great time. I think people had a really good time, and I was so happy you could make it.
I was just so sad that I had to leave. So.
Yeah. So was I, buddy.
All righty, I'll be talking to you next week.
All right, talk to you later.
So hang in there for the music break, and we'll be right back with Lori Hines. That music was by a fan of the show, Bruce Rainier. Thanks for that, Bruce. And welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks, Martin. Glad to be here.
Yes, it was. We actually shared, well, we didn't share a table. We were side by side on tables out in Phoenix. And it was a lot of fun sitting next to you.
Oh, yeah, it was an absolute blast. I met some of the most interesting people at that conference, and actually some pretty highly intelligent people, too. Very well studied as far as conspiracy theories and UFOs and all that. And, yeah, I had a blast getting to know you and some of the other vendors there, too.
Okay. Just got a message from Keith. Why don't you get a little bit closer to the phone, if you could.
Okay. All right. Is that better?
It seems better. Maybe it's the level, if you could talk a little bit louder. I know it's awful hard when I ask people to do something they never can remember for too long. But if you can, just try to be good and clear. And so we're going to be talking about a subject that I know your books that you wrote, they're basically fiction, aren't they?
Yes, I have three. It's a series called the Ancient Ones series, and they are fiction novels. They're paranormal murder mysteries, and they all take place here either in Arizona or the Southwest or the Four Corners.
Mm-hmm. But I know you did a lot of research in the subject of... Oh, say Native Americans and the star people and all that, and that's always one of the subjects that kind of fascinated me. You know, that I've heard about. I know at the UFO Congress there was I think the first speaker there was a Native American, and it's always fascinating to hear, you know, what their lore is that comes up through the generations, the storytelling, but what type of research did you end up doing for your books in regards to this?
Well, for me, it was the only places that I feature in my novels are places that I've visited, such as Havanweap National Monument and Canyon of the Ancients in the Four Corners. And my first book, one of the main settings or locations is Sunset Crater Wupaki, which is about 20 miles north of Flagstaff, and that's an amazing location. It's volcanic ruins, Indian ruins, things like that, so it's absolutely beautiful. So a lot of people say when they read the books, they're like, well, that really brings me back to the location, reminds me of places I visited because of the amount of detail you have. So for me, when I visit a place, I do visit a lot of Indian ruins and places like that, you know, prehistoric locations or historic, so that I can include those in my books.
Uh-huh. Now, if you're listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com, and it's a real easy sign-in on our chat room. The level of attendance in our chat room has been down for the last few weeks. I understand last week because I was out of town. So we're going to continue that, but if the level just keeps low, then I'm probably not going to keep going with it. And I'm sorry to waste so much time on this, but I thought I would address it. If that is the case, then we can use the Twitter feed on Dark Matter Radio Net, which is darkmatterradio.net, which is right below the podcast, the live player. So that might even be more convenient. I just like when people go to my website. I guess that's what it's all about. And by the way, since I'm talking about this, if you're go to our website. We do have a lot of blogs on there going way back when Michael Loke used to write for us. Tons of information, pages and pages of great blogs. So if you're ever bored on a Sunday or something like that, go to our website, podcastufo.com, and check out all the blogs there. Sorry for that infomercial, Lori.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. So what got you started in the fascination with this whole situation?
With the books? I actually started out doing poetry, but that was like 20 years ago, and I had actually had some poems published, and then I thought, you know, I've always wanted to do a novel, and so I started attending Writers Critiques Group and started talking to published authors, and the series itself and the subject of the series, because they are paranormal murder mysteries, started, I was actually a paranormal investigator for a couple of groups here in Phoenix, and including a TAPS family member called Sonoran Paranormal Investigations, and I believe they're still together, but some experiences that I had with that group actually got me going with the mystery and the series itself. And it started out more paranormal, supernatural. One of the main characters is Joe Luna. He's a Native American. He's a medicine man, but he's also an FBI agent. And there's a number of important characters, including a psychic medium, and her name is Lorelei Lanier. So each of these characters and the plot progresses throughout the whole series.
I see. And do you have another book in the works following?
Yes, my fourth book in the series, there'll probably be at least six, because I'm looking to do a nonfiction book, too. But the fourth book in the series is called A Piece of Time. And it's kind of, there's some fantasy elements to it. There's a scene in Ireland, I believe some scenes in Arizona, and it's kind of spread throughout the Southwest like some of the other novels are. So it's, there should be at least six, but the fourth one still needs to be edited. And then I've already started on some ideas for the fifth one as well. Go ahead.
No, well, the one you said that's nonfiction, what's that? What is your idea on that one?
That one I'm still trying to figure out. Probably something tying into Native American history and maybe even Star Children, that kind of thing, because there is a belief, many Native Americans, and not just Native Americans, believe that we have very strong ties to the stars, that we're made of stardust and things like that. A lot of people do believe that. So not quite sure. I have a friend in the Laguna Pueblo. I was up there, and he showed me around and told me a lot about the history And I think he's really wanting me to write a book about the Pueblos up there. There's 19 different Pueblos, so that would actually be pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, an astrophysicist will tell you that we are all made of stardust, basically. All the elements came from from supernovas that, so everything that we see, everything that we are, it's pretty amazing when you look at it that way. But as far as the thing that always fascinated me was the lore that goes back for, I think it goes back for, hundreds of generations that they can, I don't know how far back they can document, but still that we came from the stars. This is a Native American.
Yeah, and it's a pretty interesting subject because when you think about it, I started studying prehistory probably like about 5 years ago, and that kind of detail worked its way into my books as far as, for example, if a character was walking around in Sunset Crater Wupaki or Homolivi Ruins here in Arizona, the kind of potsherds they would see on the ground, they would mention petroglyphs or pictographs they were seeing and maybe kind of touch on prehistory. So that's kind of how it works its way into the books. But some cultures here in Arizona are the ancestral Pueblo, Mogollon, Sadawa, all very fascinating cultures from that time. And we're talking maybe late B.C. into the A.D. era, and some of them disappeared. And that's, for a lot of people, they still consider it a great mystery as to why a lot of these tribes or cultures disappeared. But I think a lot of people believe it was just migrations.
Yeah, a lot of it had to do with a lot of the speculation on that has to do with drought, drought and growing seasons. And, some of these beautiful societal cities that are, in ruins. They can't understand how so many people could have left there and just vanished. But a lot of times it will just be related to, say something like a drought.
Exactly. In some cases it was. Archaeologists used to think that it was all drought, or a lot of archaeologists and surveyors and researchers were saying it was drought. And now these days, a lot of them are saying it depends on the site, it depends on the culture. In a lot of cases, it could have been political instability, and probably was, as you had other cultures and other tribes moving into the area. And as you mentioned, in a lot of cases, they had no choice but to move on. They had no resources, no water. They had to do those migrations. And I've talked to people at the UFO conference and other people who believe it's a huge mystery. I've talked to people who believe that, the Native Americans were returned to the stars where they came from. Hmm. Spaceships literally came and took them. In Mesa Verde, there's a site. I didn't see it when I visited there, but I'm not sure it's off the main trail, but there's supposedly a huge round rock that's just big enough for a UFO to land on. And some people actually, and there was a Native American woman that took a tour of, led a tour of people out to that site, and she mentioned that, it's big enough for a UFO to land on, so it actually landed and then took them back up to the stars. And I actually met some people at the UFO conference that thought that would be the case.
Well, I know Dr. Lynn Katai was there at the conference, and when I had her on the show, a year and a half ago, she had done some research into the Native American cultures in regards to, UFOs and their stories that were passed down. And she said that somewhere in the desert around there in the Phoenix area, there were like drawings on rocks, not in caves or something, that actually like a triangle, like the Phoenix Lights. Have you ever heard of anything like that around there?
Not as far as a triangle. I've come across in my research, there's a picture of two UFOs together, and there's actually a Navajo or a Diné myth behind it. And I kind of mention this briefly in my presentation sometimes, but there's a myth that one UFO came down, broke down, was on Earth, and then another just like it came down and rescued it. Now, there's a whole myth behind it. It's like two or three pages of mythology behind that, but that's, kind of the gist behind it. And you do see a lot of rock art here of what people call ant people. And there's debate. Some people you talk to, including the UFO theorists, will say, well, the Native Americans actually they saw these UFOs, they saw these aliens, And that's why these drawings or petroglyphs and pictographs are on the rocks and on the panels. And some people, including Hopi, there's a myth called the Ant People, and the Ant People actually took the Hopi underground and taught them the merits of food storage and sustenance and actually saved them from starvation. So is it that they saw UFOs or that it's related to their mythology of the ant, you know, the Ant People? Maybe it's some of both. I mean, I have no doubt that they might have seen UFOs. Some of them probably did, considering how many sightings we have today. Was there more back then? So it's pretty interesting when you do see a lot of the rock art.
Yes. I really don't think the time element has much to do with UFO sightings.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, you know, the skeptics or debunkers or a lot of people say, oh, yeah, this whole thing started in 1947, you know, and Roswell, and, you know, it was all because of, you know, people went crazy over the media and everything. But if you look hard enough, you can find the possibility of sightings. A lot of it's not very clear. You know, there's something out there. People are talking about Alexander the Great had a UFO sighting. But that was, you know, basically debunked because that was just something that was made up in 1952 in a book or something like that. It is really hard to research things like this, and especially when it goes into history and the written word and what's out there. You know, the cave drawings and are ancient and are very intriguing, all the different figures. And then there are ant-like people. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but there are ant-looking people on some of those rocks. All very, really intriguing.
And, yeah, like Nevada and Utah supposedly have a lot of that. It's really all over the world, too. And a lot of people do look at that and say that's evidence that they saw UFOs. And as you mentioned, as far as the time thing, I'm sure they did. I'm sure a lot of them did. This didn't just start with Roswell. That might be one of the major recorded events, but it had to have started long before that.
Yeah, I think there was someone at the conference, Cheryl Costa, that actually came up to me when we were sitting together and said, you know, she wanted to be on the show. 200 years of UFOs in New York. I am interested in that. So I would like to have her on, and I was thinking about having two New York people on at the same time coming up in a show soon. But, I think the whole thing is, speculation, but still it's fascinating. Do you have any – did you actually interview any Native American people directly, or was this just other types of research?
Well, I have talked casually. Like, I had my own radio show called Under the Surface, and I did interview a lot of Native Americans, mostly from the Southwest, but I think I might have had a Cherokee person on, Lakota, people like that, but most of them were from the Southwest because the events I attend are arts festivals here in the Southwest. But we never really got into a discussion as far as the UFOs. Usually it was more prehistory. But some of them do believe, you know, that there are ties as far as the mythology to the Ant People and things like that. And the research I've done, some people I've talked to, they do think that the Ant People that you see on the rocks could tie back to the mythology. And when I talk to some UFO people, they're like, oh, no, that just indicates they've actually seen aliens, and maybe it's some of both.
Uh-huh. One of the things you hear a lot, and actually I heard people talking at the conference about this, is kind of like the mystery of ancient life. And, you know, the discovery of people are talking about, oh, there's, you know, Roman artifacts found in somewhere in the Americas or things like that. What do you think about all that? Do you have an opinion on the possibility that, you know, we were visited by other countries way, you know, that weren't supposed to be here, pre-Columbian?
Well, it's kind of interesting because one of the things I talk about in the presentations is cranial deformation. And if anybody's ever watched Ancient Aliens, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably have, that's something I work into the talks. And the Mayans were very heavy into cranial deformation, as well as the Germanic Huns and other cultures, even ancestral Puebloan. There's evidence of the Hohokam people here in Phoenix. There have been skulls found that they think the reason for these deformations is to kind of pray to the alien gods, or because of sightings they've had and things like that. The Mayans in particular, in a lot of cases they're deformed because the women put their babies in these cradle boards and working in the fields and things like that. So after time, their skulls get deformed. But the Mayans actually had deliberate skull deformation. It was like a major cultural thing. And when one of the Spanish explorers actually asked one of the Mayans, why do you do this? They said, quote, this is done because our ancestors were told by the gods that if our heads were thus formed, we should appear noble and handsome and better able to bear burdens. When you consider the size of the skull, that kind of makes sense. I don't know if I necessarily agree with the actual alien tie-in to that. Just the size of the skull, better able to bear burdens and make them, they actually consider it to make them more attractive.
Have you ever heard of the Lloyd Pye's Star Child skull?
Yes, actually I did. I tried to get a hold of someone from that experiment from that project to be on my show, and I never heard back.
Yeah, Lloyd passed away, I think it was 2 years ago now or so, somewhere around there. And I'm curious to find out what the status is of that. It's kind of funny. For some reason, that show I did with Lloyd Pye is my absolute number one listened to show. It's still getting thousands of listens. I don't know exactly why. But I guess there's a lot of people interested in that. And in particular, that skull is very, very puzzling. It's almost beyond deformity.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting compared to, like, you know, like I was just talking about the normal cranial deformation and stuff like that. And as far as, like, the Star Child thing, a lot of people I talk to say, what is that? What is a Star Child? But there's so much more beyond that. I mean, Star Children, I guess in a way all of us are Star Children, but there's a purpose for Star Children and I'm sure, you know, this probably was touched on during your interview with him, but there's a reason that Star Children are here, supposedly to make the planet better and stronger. We've got so many wars going on, and it's just, I mean, it's really scary, in my opinion, the direction we're heading. And for Star Children, there's different levels of Star Children. A lot of sites you go on will say there's three different types, rainbow and crystal and indigo being the three main types. But I've actually talked to people who add two different categories to that, platinum and diamond, who are the newer versions of Star Children. And one of these people, and I've talked to other people as well, that can actually, they have the ability to download languages from alien species. They'll just find themselves talking these specific languages. And I'm sure in some cases it's totally fake, but this one woman I know, she's highly intelligent, and just the fact that she can do that, and I think I met somebody else at the UFO Congress too that either said they knew somebody that did that, and it might have been somebody at the conference themselves, but it's pretty fascinating what's happening and the abilities that these Star Children have. I mean, some of them can even contact extraterrestrials and call the UFOs to Earth. They're telepathic, they can levitate, and they actually, a lot of them have physical characteristics like that of an actual alien. Their skulls are the big skulls, they have the large almond-shaped eyes, and in my fourth book I actually developed a character, she's a Star Child, based on that description, kind of.
Now, where are these descriptions coming from?
Oh, as far as the Star Children?
Mm-hmm.
They supposedly, well, the physical characteristics, there's different sites I've looked on, and they all, you know, kind of share the same characteristics. And they think because they are Star Children and they do have that ability, a lot of them are said to look just like that. And I've kind of seen pictures of some. I think a lot of them are, just look like normal children. It's just they have those, they have extrasensory abilities. They're just remarkable in what they can do, particularly calling aliens to the planet, being able to communicate with aliens. I don't know if that necessarily means they're being abducted. I don't think so. I think it's on a whole different level. But there's some remarkable abilities, being able to walk by, you know. I actually have a friend in Roswell that took a test. There's tests you can take to determine if you're a star child. I'm not necessarily, you know, I wouldn't call that scientific evidence, but I've talked to people who say that they can walk by light bulbs and on the street lamps and things like that, and they'll explode. And that's supposed to be a main thing as well, a main characteristic. I've heard a lot of people say that.
I always wanted to be able to do that.
That would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I've never been able to do that.
You know, one of the things, getting back to the Native American culture and the Hopi, I believe it's the Hopi, that have Kachina dolls?
Yes.
And what is the story behind the Kachina dolls? I've heard some people say it has something to do with, you know, star people or something like that. But I don't even know what the background is on that.
Well, I'm kind of still studying. A lot of the culture I've been studying is the Navajo and some Hopi. But the Kachinas are essentially gods. And they kind of pertain to the different mountains and some different areas here in Arizona. And they are considered, yes, to be from the stars, very, very spiritual beings. And they're tied into the daily lives of the Hopi.
Uh-huh. And these some of these examples, being in the, you know, fine arts and antiques, I've handled pretty early Kachina dolls. They've been around for a long time. I don't know when the tradition started, but they're, some of them are absolutely beautiful.
And it's sad, like, because the Navajo do have versions of Kachina dolls, but the Hopi are said to be the real authentic thing. And it's not like the Navajo, I mean, they make some remarkable looking ones too. But I believe with the Hopi, I think it starts like with the children when they're babies. I think the Kachinas are kind of tied in with that, and with helping them develop, and it kind of ties into the children, more so the little girls and the little babies that are born. Mm-hmm. So it kind of starts with that. But yeah, that goes back quite a ways.
Now, does any of your research or any of this go into Mexico itself, or is it all like basically in the States?
Mostly in the States, but I've done, like, as far as when I mentioned the cranial deformation, it kind of ties back to the Mayans, and I've done kind of some studying as far as Mesoamerica, because there was Pupteca traders that went back and forth from, they were kind of elite merchant military class, and they went back and forth, they were traders between Mesoamerica and maybe the Chaco Canyon area, Four Corners, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of some of the tomb shaft figures that come out are really, really bizarre. Talk about alien looking. You never see too much about that either on TV or anything, or Ancient Aliens. I don't know if I haven't watched a whole lot of that, but I've never really seen some of these pre-Columbian figures that are, you know, there's also the... I'm trying to remember that there's sort of Chinese looking, and there's a name for it. It just slips my mind right now. But there's these were dug up for, you know, 2,000 years old in these tomb shafts usually by farmers in the Mexican fields would dig these figures up. But talk about looking like aliens. They should have more pictures of those out there. Do you understand what I'm talking about, these clay figures?
I'd have to do research on that. I don't know anything about those. I mean, I know there are similar symbols, like when you hear information about the feathered serpent and things like that associated with Mesoamerica. There's a village called Pakime in Mesoamerica, and you would actually see similar symbols found in Pakime in Chaco Canyon and things like that. There's similar statues and similar symbols that would be found between both villages. So I know there's been a lot of question as to migrations and the type of people that lived in Mesoamerica and their migrations into Chaco Canyon and into that area.
Yeah, we always think of the border of between the U.S. and Mexico, but, you know, you go back a couple thousand years, well, actually just a few hundred years, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't there. So that's kind of where that came from. Anyway, what are some other things that when you were doing your research that you've uncovered as far as like the stories, the Native American stories in relation to, you know, the Star Children?
Let's see. Well, on the Star Children, I've just been doing a lot of research on their abilities, the types of Star Children, maybe their physical characteristics. Most, I believe, just look fairly normal. I think there are the exceptions. I've come across some Navajo mythology, one of the main locations, and the second book, and I think it's mentioned in some of the other books after that as part of the series, is Shiprock Peak. And there's certain mythology and legend behind Shiprock Peak, as well as a lot of other sacred sites. In particular, to the Star Children, I don't know if that necessarily relates back to the Star Children, but Shiprock Peak is actually said, some of these sites are actually said to have UFO bases underneath, and that's one of them. I was doing a signing in Flagstaff, and I can't remember if he was Navajo or Hopi or if he said, but he mentioned it. He's like, did you know there are actually UFOs under Shiprock Peak? Mm-hmm. And I know in Dulce, New Mexico, I think a lot of people know about that one. That is supposedly a base as well. And Shiprock Peak is a very strong location. You just type it in and you get all kinds of pretty fascinating information that comes up about it. And there's supposedly ley lines associated with the Shiprock Peak and things like that as well. So it's a very interesting location, a very high-energy location. Some people think Sedona, Arizona is a pretty high-energy location, but to me, which it is, but Shiprock Peak kind of blows that away. You just drive up to it, and the energy you feel, I mean, you can actually feel the humming and the energy behind it. Now, does that mean there's a UFO base underneath? No, not necessarily, but my husband and I visited their ex-husband about 20 years ago, and he decided to relieve himself on the base of Shiprock. And all of a sudden, a woman's voice, I know, yeah, I looked at him like, you're nuts, and all of a sudden, a woman's voice just rang out, and there was no one around, no cars. This is like the middle of the reservation out there, kind of. I mean, it's getting a little bit more developed, but all of a sudden, a woman's voice rang out, and you could hear her singing, and it sounded like an older woman, but, you know, it's kind of a little hard to tell, but people get the shivers when I tell them that, and he looked at me, and he's like, you know, I don't think I should have done that.
Yeah, that'll stop him.
So, people laugh when I tell them that, either that or their eyes get really big. They're like, your ex-husband wasn't that bright, was he? So, that was a very interesting experience. That really was.
Yeah, you know, I think there is something to these places in regards to some type of energy. I mean, there's a lot of things that just don't make any sense as far as, you know, the paranormal activity in a certain area. You know, and it just really makes you wonder. You know, a lot of times it comes up the Skinwalker Ranch, and I just heard from George Knapp today that, you know, hopefully in March, he's going to be on our show and talk about that. You know, that fascinates me, and there's so many things that were going on there. And,
yeah,
you know, I know that's north of northwest of Phoenix by many hundreds of miles, but, you know, that's just all fascinates me.
Yeah, that was a fascinating location. There's all kinds of interesting stuff going on at that place.
Yeah, UFO sightings for many years, and there are Native American cultures all around there as well.
Yeah, and then there's all kinds of, like, I think cattle mutilations were involved in that, and, you know, UFOs and skinwalkers, yeah.
Yeah, and keep going. There's, like, cryptoids and Bigfoot and, you know, large wolves and dogs, and, boy, I mean, just so much stuff. It just seems like a science fiction movie. You know, the things that people were reporting there. And, you know, there were people that were taking some serious scientific study there after Bob Bigelow, you know, bought the ranch. And, you know, they really looked into things that were really happening, but unexplainable still. And, of course, everyone wants to know about evidence. That's always the tough part.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, thought that that was drummed up and a lot of it was fake. And I mean, the family supposedly only lived there for two and a half years and then moved out because of the amount of stuff going on. But
yeah, they couldn't take it anymore.
That's pretty heavy duty if all that is true. So
right. Are there any other places that you're aware of? You said, is it Sonoma? No. What was the name of the?
Oh, the Shiprock Peak?
Yeah. Are there any other places like that that you're aware of that you visited? Or?
Well, that's as far as all the ones. All of them are kind of spiritual to me, just because I have proof that I have past lives as a Native American. A lot, of course, a lot of people have. It's, you know, that's no surprise. A lot of people feel they have ties to Native American past. Some have had many. So for me to visit Indian ruins, petroglyph sites, things like that are very spiritual, very important. When I go to national parks, which a lot of the locations in the books are national parks or BLM land, things like that, it's pretty much Chaco Canyon's an amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to, there's a geologist author friend that, she feels she has ties to a lot of these places as well. And Stonehenge, she said, I think she said Stonehenge was the most powerful place for her. So I think for each person it's different. But for me, I make an effort to visit Indian ruins. And I prefer to visit more remote locations, like in the Four Corners on the border of Colorado and Utah was both Hub and Wheat National Monument and Canyon of the Ancients. So you kind of, it's interesting because you've got national park land that kind of crosses over with BLM land or the Bureau of Land Management, but there's some amazing, just hundreds and hundreds of sites, some of which are still undiscovered, and just amazing sites up there. The one that's a cover, it's on the cover of my third book, is part of Canyon of the Ancients, and it's called Painted Hand Pueblo. And it's a cool little site. It's kind of like a steep trail that goes down to it, but it's not a long walk. You just kind of walk around some of the ruins and then go back up. But that's just one of the many, many sites there that you can explore. It's, you could spend years up there exploring.
Wow. Well, I was, in my 20s or so, I went to Four Corners, and there was something really, I mean, I felt like I had to get the heck out of there. I don't know. It was a really weird area. I don't know how else to explain the feeling I had. Probably nothing paranormal at all, but.
Well, sometimes, was it just kind of a negative feeling? Or
yeah,
just,
yes, okay, it was. Yeah. It was like, get out of here or something. You know, I felt like it, almost like there was some type of danger. So we have just a minute or so left. Do you have a website, right?
Yes, my books, three books that are out now are on Amazon, both in print and ebook. But yeah, I do have a site on WordPress, and you can either go to WordPress and just type in my name, or it's LH, my initials for Lori Hines, author, AUTHOR.wordpress.com, and that'll take you right to my website.
Well, very good. Well, it's been a real pleasure. You were very kind when we sat next together, and it's been a real pleasure speaking to you tonight.
That was great meeting you as well, and I appreciate you having me on the show.
Very good. Thank you. And I'm going to be signing you off, and I don't do this very often, switch guests in the middle of the stream here, but if you're listening live, hang in, and thanks again, Lori.
All right. Thank you.
So that's it for the free part of this show. If you want to listen to the second part, all you have to do is subscribe for $1 a month or more at podcastufo.com. You'll see right on our sidebar, we have all that sign-up information. Stephen Bassett is coming up in hour two to talk about Podesta, disclosure, and more. So I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. First of all, Alejandro Rojas with the news. I want to thank our guest, Lori Hines, and I want to thank our music people, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse and Bruce Renier for supplying the music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out next week live, the full show on the Dark Matter Radio Network, or and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.